there's the feeling of your body being against you, essentially, and feeling totally powerless because there's nothing you can do about it. It's been incredibly lonely, exhausting, having to fight for myself, people not knowing how to support me. I will stand up on stage in front of 800 people, because if that makes one person feel less alone, then that's worth it. So I wouldn't necessarily say I feel brave. I feel privileged that I feel able to do that. I'm less good about doing it for myself. Get curious and ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Challenge what success looks like to you. We see it on Instagram. Our feeds are saturated with people driving Lamborghinis, going on expensive holidays, looking beautiful. We have this aesthetic of what success is, and nobody really challenges that.
Tabitha is a civil servant in Strategic Command with a powerful story about redefining success. Through deep self-reflection, she realized the path she was on didn't quite fit and made bold, honest choices to change direction. That shift wasn't without risk, but it's led her to unexpected places, a healthier relationship with failure, and a deep commitment to curiosity. Tabitha also shares her experience of living with endometriosis, a condition that affects 1 in 10 women and is the second most common gynecological condition in the UK. This is a chance to learn and, more importantly, to better understand how we can support someone professionally or personally on the endo journey, or anyone dealing with women's health conditions. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Tabitha.
I had been doing all the wrong things for all the wrong reasons for a long time, and I got to a point where my mental and physical health was not the best, and I realised I needed to make a change. And I reflected back on why I had been doing what I had. I reevaluated, and then I saw a job that was more aligned with me, and I decided to go for it. I've always been quite career focused. I've made decisions based on what would get me to where I want to be. So when I was doing my postgraduate degree, I was a special constable, realised I didn't really like it, would not recommend getting pepper sprayed. Then I was made aware of the Army Reserves, so decided to join whilst also changing jobs and going into the police as a civilian. I joined the Army Reserves as a soldier because I had 2 degrees. They sent me down the officer route, qualified as a soldier, started my officer training. At no point did anybody ask me, why are you doing what you're doing? It was just what was expected of me because I had the qualifications, because I had the leadership skills. You know, it's very prestigious, and there are lots of benefits to being an army officer, such as getting your own room and getting a bigger bed and nicer dining. You do lose a lot of the camaraderie and the banter that comes with soldiering, so I very much miss that. But it got to the point where I was on exercise having panic attacks in a field. I was asking people, do you think I can do this? Because I didn't have any self-belief that I actually could. And what I was actually looking for was someone to ask me, why are you doing this? And no one did. And it wasn't until I was balancing being a probationary second lieutenant and my full-time job as an intelligence officer that I was really, really unhappy. And I was actually asked the question of, why are you doing this? So I got into the habit of doing what I thought was expected, doing what I thought would get me strategically to the place that I wanted to be. But then the result was I got there and I was miserable, and I was having a mental and physical reaction to being miserable. So I asked for a leave of absence from the Army Reserves, because I think a key aspect of leadership is knowing when you're not the right person to lead the people. And I wasn't doing the soldiers justice. And then I decided to resign my commission, which I was told by many people would be career suicide. But I'd done everything to be what I thought was successful, and I was miserable. So something had to change.
The analysis that you did to make you realize that you were doing things for the wrong reasons, was it just because someone asked you why? And are you now saying why quite a lot?
I think there's two answers to that question. It was both getting curious as to why I was doing things and changing my relationship with failure. Because I avoided stepping away for a really long time because I didn't want to feel like I had failed. So figuring out why I was actually doing it and what I actually did want instead, and getting comfortable with failure.
I think that's an enormously brave thing to do. I think plenty of people just carry on doing what they've been doing for fear of the judgment that might come with doing something differently. Did you feel liberated by being brave?
I don't know if I've ever thought about it like that, to be honest. It was terrifying. I didn't know if I was making the right decision because I didn't know what the next step looked like. And because previously I'd always been really strategic in terms of making career decisions, it's easier to know. But when you are making decisions based on your understanding of yourself, that's a lot harder because we aren't raised to have an understanding of ourselves. I felt relief because I wasn't letting people down, and I felt relief from the burden of responsibility that I was putting on myself. So it was liberating in that sense. The what next was kind of terrifying.
And what was next?
I continued my role as an intelligence officer. I trained as a CrossFit coach, and then I realized that it wasn't just the Army Reserves that wasn't right for me. It was where I was living. It's the job I was doing. So I'd been on the lookout for my next role. And then the job I'm currently in came up. I decided to take a risk and move. So new location, new job, new organization.
We met at the fantastic Defence Women's Network conference, and you were on a panel talking about menstruation, bleeding, and endometriosis, I think. And you spoke very powerfully in front of about 800 people about your experiences of endometriosis. And I wondered how you found yourself on the stage, first of all, giving that talk.
I felt like a rock star. I loved it. Turns out that's where I belong. I felt incredibly fortunate to be given the platform to talk about something that impacts so many people, yet doesn't get enough recognition. Fortunately, when you're talking about lived experience, you can't really go wrong. After I finished speaking on the stage, I bumped into General Jim, who heads Strategic Command, and he offered support. I was invited to the executive committee to give a brief on what endometriosis is and what provisions are needed in Strategic Command to better support those impacted by endometriosis. Myself and my co-presenter, who is a military representative, presented our recommendations to STRATCOM. They were all approved. Everyone was really engaged on the panel, and STRATCOM have decided to become an endo-friendly employer.
Many people won't know what endometriosis is. I confess I didn't know until a really good friend of ours told us that she had it. Please tell us, what is endometriosis?
So I am not a specialist here, but endometriosis is where cells similar to those in the lining of the womb grow outside of the womb. There are four different stages. It can cause adhesions where the organs actually fuse together. The cells have the same function as those in the womb, so they bleed every month, but the blood has nowhere to go. Symptoms are really varied. It can go from inflammation, brain fog, fatigue, cramping. It's very, very under-researched, so not a lot of people know what it is, what causes it, how to treat it. At the moment, there is no treatment. It's just management. It affects 1 in 10 women, so it's quite common.
I have some sense, because people I love are on that journey as well. And yet there'll be people here listening that won't have any comprehension about what it actually means to have endometriosis. Can you give a sense of how tough it's been?
For me, it starts with my sister and watching the agony of her trying to become a mum and being told by doctors that she's a drama queen when she was trying to get diagnosed. Me thinking that she was just lazy when actually she had a medical condition, and seeing the impact it's had on her. That is what scared me so much about getting diagnosed myself, because I didn't want that. And then I started to get the really painful cramps. I'd be driving to work and I'd have a spasm that was so painful, I thought, I can't be in the car or I'll crash it. So I had to pull over. The brain fog. For me, I would say the brain fog is the worst, because I am really proud of my ability to think. I love my brain. And then when you've got brain fog, you can't find the words. You can't think. And it's almost as if you lose who you are for that period of time. And that's incredibly challenging, especially when you're in a environment where your brain is so important to your job, because there can be days where I just can't get as much as I need to done because my brain's not working with me. And there's the feeling of your body being against you, essentially, and feeling totally powerless because there's nothing you can do about it until you know what it is that you're dealing with. And then even still, it's not researched enough to have a clear understanding of what to do about it. It's been incredibly lonely, exhausting, having to fight for myself, people not knowing how to support me, not being offered support in some cases. You know, there's the time aspect when it comes to all the medical appointments that I didn't have any policy protecting me, so I had to take either as annual leave or work longer hours to compensate. And that puts stress on your body and you're already exhausted. And then having days where I feel completely drained and I can't do the things that I enjoy because my body is exhausted.
One of the problems with endometriosis, as I understand it, is that it takes a very long time for people to be diagnosed. I think the average length of time for diagnosis is about 8 years.
Because there is such a long diagnostic time frame, you could actually end up in a situation where your endometriosis continues to grow. And unfortunately for my sister, it was the case that by the time she got diagnosed, mid-20s, she was infertile because her organs had fused together so severely that it wasn't going to be possible for her to conceive naturally. It has quite severe consequences if left untreated for such a long period of time. The first obstacle is yourself. It's identifying that something is wrong. Women don't really talk about their periods, but it's quite common that, you know, cramping is a thing. Most people have the understanding of, you know, get them chocolate and a hot water bottle. But what that actually does is it normalizes period pain, and period pain actually isn't normal. We aren't programmed to think that this is unusual. And because the symptoms aren't consistent across each menstrual cycle, you could go months without having any issues. And then for the next few months, you're in agony. Typically for myself, summer months are really good. Winter months, terrible. That's when my immune system's shot and I'm more stressed. I'm more susceptible to inflammation anyway. It took me a really long time to admit to myself that this might be endometriosis. Then once you make the decision to seek diagnosis, God, that's a whole different battlefield. Because it's not very well researched, not a lot of doctors are aware of it. Even not a lot of gynecologists are aware of it. So you can go to the doctor with all these symptoms and they will say, okay, take the pill. I requested a consultation with a gynecologist, got put on a wait list. He didn't do an internal examination, said, I think you've got enlarged ovaries, take the pill. My symptoms continued. I was having a smear test and I was talking to the nurse about it, because at this point I'd tell any medical professional what was going on. And she said, you can actually get a second opinion. I didn't realise that was possible. So I went back to my doctor and requested a second opinion. I then went to a different consultant. They said, okay, given your family history, given your symptoms, we will look at doing a diagnostic laparoscopy if your symptoms persist. Within a month, I was on the floor in the fetal position in complete agony. And I was like, I can't wait. So I phoned up the doctor and I said, I need an emergency appointment. He wasn't available. So I saw a different consultant. She said, I don't think it's endometriosis, but if you want a laparoscopy, if you want surgery, we'll put you forward for it. And at that point, I'm sat there thinking, I'm not the medical professional here. I could be signing myself up for surgery that isn't needed. I don't know. And I've had so many medical professionals saying I don't think it is endometriosis. So I wasn't really sure what to do. But at that point, I'd been fighting my corner for so long and I knew something wasn't right. So I was like, okay, I want on the wait list. And I had my laparoscopy. So laparoscopy is the only way that you can actually diagnose endometriosis. It's abdominal surgery. They put a camera in and they have a look around and see if they can see any endometrial growth. At that point, they can surgically remove it, depending on the severity of the growth. So I then got my diagnosis of endometriosis. Although laparoscopy is the only way that you can diagnose endometriosis, you are then at the mercy of the knowledge of the specialist. So you can have a laparoscopy, but if the surgeon isn't a specialist in endometriosis, they may actually miss it.
Knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to younger versions of yourself at the start of the journey?
No matter how many no's you get, you know your body. So keep pushing. Keep a diary of all your symptoms, because that is your evidence for going to the doctor and saying, well, all of these things only happen at this point in my cycle, or that it's consistent, or it just gives you the evidence that you need to say there is something wrong here. And then also knowing that you can get a second opinion, going on Endometriosis UK, the website is fantastic. It has loads of resources in terms of self-advocacy, because it is exhausting having to fight your corner.
Presumably that'd be a great place to start for a line manager.
Yeah, so when you're part of the Endometriosis Friendly Employer Scheme, you get access to lots of resources. Once we have that in place for Strategic Command, there will be resources available to line managers because they have a section about how to manage people with endometriosis. I wouldn't necessarily recommend just Googling endometriosis because of the fact that there's so little research. I'd just be mindful of the quality of the information absorbed. So first point of call, Endometriosis UK. Secondly, talking to the individual that you're managing and being able to have that conversation. If you know you don't have the skill set to have that conversation, let's get some training on how to have emotionally sensitive conversations. Get curious and get comfortable. We really need a culture shift where we prioritize health and well-being and we prioritize the people over the products.
Can we talk about where you are now on your journey? Because it seems to me that you've gone a very long way round to get to a point where you know what you've got and you are better understanding how you're managing that. You're making progress in the workplace too for them to better understand how to get the best from you. What does the future look like now that you know those things?
We're hoping to put together lots of information about what endometriosis is, how you can be line managed with endometriosis, what's available to you when you have endometriosis. Once you've had your laparoscopy, how should you be returning to work? What kind of physio should you be doing? How can we make that transition as comfortable as possible? All the things that I wish I had known. It's not just for people who are managing endometriosis, but also those who are impacted, whether that be colleagues, partners, because it can be really difficult to support something you don't really understand.
Having those conversations early must be the obvious and sensible thing to do.
Yeah, that's really important. And that's where it takes a lot of courage from the individual, because when you are currently being told by medical professionals, we don't think you have it. No, I don't think you have it. To go up to your line manager and say, I think I've got this. All the professionals are telling me no, but I think I've got it. Like, if you were a line manager, how would you receive that? Probably not particularly well. But if you had an understanding of endometriosis and knew that it was common to get misdiagnosed, perhaps you'd be more supported.
And of course, all of the time, it's affecting your performance in the workplace. And so anything that can be done to make it easier ought to be a thing that good line managers are trying to pursue.
Definitely. And I think in addition to workplace performance, it's the social aspect of it as well. The diagnostic journey, like you've alluded to, is incredibly isolating at times. So when you are in an environment where you feel supported by your colleagues and your line manager, and you have access to a support network, it gives you the strength that you don't necessarily have when you're just going it alone.
There's a difference between having a policy and doing the right thing. Oftentimes, you shouldn't need a policy to know what the right thing is.
I would love it if that was the case. It's entirely dependent on your organisation. From my perspective, there's a gap between what we're aiming for in terms of putting people first and what that looks like in practice. And I think there's a big culture shift to take place before what we're saying in principle is matched with what's happening in practice. When you're in a public organisation and there is that risk aversion, policy is safe for people. Because if you're audited, you can say, well, this is my justification. Arguably, if you were audited, you could say, well, I had this conversation on this day. This was made apparent to me. This is the decision I made. The police do it quite often. They have a decision-making logbook so that they can make sure that any decision they made is justified. If we encourage people to connect and make decisions and say your decision can be supported as long as you provide a clear rationale, then people don't feel as reliant on policy. And the difference is empowering line managers versus restricting them. And I know I've talked about having policy to cover sick leave and whatnot. I think that is just a practical piece of the puzzle. But when it comes to number of days, what that looks like, what's needed, that comes from the conversation with you and your line manager. And unless line managers feel empowered to make decisions and empowered to have the conversations, then you have people that don't know how to ask for what they need. They don't know what's available. They self-isolate. And ultimately, they end up leaving the organization because they don't get the support that they actually need.
What is remarkable is that you're prepared to take risks in order to better understand what is right for you. Is that advice you would give to other young people stepping out in their careers?
Definitely. Get curious and ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Challenge what success looks like to you. Really understand what success is on your terms. We see it on Instagram, our feeds are saturated with people driving Lamborghinis, going on expensive holidays, looking beautiful, really physically fit. We have this aesthetic of what success is, and nobody really challenges that. In my school, we were very university orientated, so success was all about grades. It was all performance related. When we're looking at the aesthetic on Instagram, again, it's performance related. It's how do other people perceive me? And my value is tied to that. Whereas actually, I would encourage people to consider what success feels like to you. When am I happiest? When do I feel like I am the most fulfilled? When am I being the version of myself that I enjoy the most? And then follow that. Because if you chase the version of success as defined externally by other people, you can end up having panic attacks in a field.
That's really difficult to do with young people who may lack confidence and who have a peer group that measures success in a particularly superficial way, for example. So how would you advise people to set themselves up for success?
Get curious, reflect, have open and meaningful conversations. We are terrible at having meaningful conversations. don't be scared to try new things. Joining a CrossFit community was massively transformative in terms of my perspective on success, failure, my relationship with my body. And joining a CrossFit gym was quite intimidating. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to the gym and everyone's there with their tops off and six packs, and you think, I don't belong here. You have a bit of imposter syndrome. By having the courage to take that first step into the gym and be open to possibilities, I have learned so much from it. So my advice would be, get curious, be courageous, and also be open.
I remember hearing you say there's a British resistance to the emotional intimacy that comes with meaningful conversation, but that is where the richness is. That suggests to me that small talk isn't a thing you terribly enjoy, but how easy is it to do that, particularly with British people who might be reticent to be open and honest?
I hate small talk. I cannot stand it. I want to get to know you, not who you think you should be in front of me. And we can only do that if we're both going to be open with each other. Otherwise, it's an intimacy blocker. You're presenting a facade, I'm presenting a facade, and neither of us are actually getting the connection that as animals we need. We underestimate the value of social connection for our survival.
And that's equally true, I suspect, not just in social relationships, but also in the workplace, where trust is central. Have you found that also in your workplace, the reticence to have honesty and open conversations? And what impact does that have on the culture?
That is a very big question with a very big answer. We spend more time with the people we work with than the people we love. So the people we are around, the organizational culture, is so important for our well-being. And if we don't have an environment where we feel psychologically safe to share our ideas, to build relationships with individuals, and to really develop ourselves, we're not going to get the best out of ourselves or through that interaction. So nobody wins. In the workplace, we typically tend to be a lot more risk averse. So there's not really much room for play. We don't really see the value of being silly sometimes. Like even just going outside for 10 minutes and throwing a ball around, it works wonders for your mood and then your focus. We don't necessarily have the best relationship with failure because we can't fail, especially when you're a public organization. There's so much risk associated with failure. However, it is the scientific method. In order to evolve, we need to be failing. We need to figure out what our weak points are. We need to be looking for those weak points rather than avoiding them like the plague for reputational damage. There's a resistance to failure, and with that comes a resistance to innovation, because failure and innovation go hand in hand. And then equally, success. What do we think success looks like? Is success the number of products we produce? Or is it the happiness and the performance of our people, our retention, their well-being?
What other things have you found that work for you to make it better or less worse?
For myself, managing my stress levels, I would recommend that to every single person, irrespective of whether you've got a health condition or not. Because if you don't manage your stress levels, you will get a health condition. So managing my stress levels, sleep. Sleep is the foundation of absolutely everything. Nutrition, I would always recommend speaking to a nutritional therapist to find out what works for you, because everybody's different. And fitness, exercise, movement. It can be quite counterintuitive, but when you're having those muscular spasms, your body is contracting. So what you actually need to be doing is moving it so you can release the muscles. So really taking a holistic approach to well-being, that's mind, body, and social connectivity.
You talked about the strength and power of the community of people that do CrossFit and the preparedness to support each other and to look out for each other. Why do you think that is?
CrossFit creates compassion. When you are doing a workout, you are both struggling through it and all barriers are removed. It doesn't matter what your job is, what race you are, what beliefs you are. you have the shared experience of being in that pain cave. It's very similar to the military in that regard. Shared suffering can be so unifying. Now, I'm not saying that CrossFit is all suffering. It can be a bit sadistic. But what it allows for is the opportunity to be unified in shared experience, whether you are doing a really heavy weight, whether you're doing a lightweight, we are all moving through the same workout. We are all moving through the same experience. We're all struggling in our own way. So there's real unification in that shared suffering, and that fosters compassion, which is human connection from shared experience. And it goes a step further when you then cheer that person on. And I'm going to support you. I'm going to get you through this. And that's where community breeds. It doesn't need to be CrossFit. This can be any group where you are sharing a same experience.
Listening to what you say, there's a real bravery about you. Have you always been brave, or have you grown to be brave, or do you not think you're brave at all?
I think I've always had the ability to stand up for others. I'm terrible at doing it for myself, but I know that I have the passion and the power to drive things that other people wouldn't necessarily be comfortable doing. And I will stand up on stage in front of 800 people, because if that makes one person feel less alone, then that's worth it. So I wouldn't necessarily say I feel brave. I feel privileged that I feel able to do that. I'm less good about doing it for myself.
The obvious question is, why is that?
I feel it comes down to self-worth. We live in a society where we don't actually encourage people to recognize their value, their intrinsic value. And that goes back to our ideas of success. Everything is external. Your worth is dependent on what you can do and what you can give to others, what you've achieved. So I think my ability to self-advocate is inherently tied to my feelings of self-worth.
Now you know you have endometriosis. What does good look like for you in 5 years' time?
Good looks like changing our relationship with failure and success, so we are actually empowering people and being more inclusive. Good looks like taking a holistic approach to well-being and not treating physical, mental, and social in isolation, because you can have a gym membership to deal with your physical health. You can, if you can afford it, go see a therapist to deal with your mental health, join a group to promote your social health. But when I'm in the gym training, my mental health is still impacting me. So treating it in isolation isn't going to help. We really need to understand that these three things in combination impact the individual. So our response needs to consider how they are interlinked.
While we talked about endometriosis, what really came through was Tabitha's determination to redefine success, viewing mind, body and soul as one whole picture. Her bravery has meant taking informed risks and making choices rooted in self-awareness. It's a powerful reminder of the value in understanding yourself before chasing anyone else's version of success. Tabitha also shared some brilliant practical suggestions for line managers supporting someone on the endo journey. If you too have some helpful tools, resources or tips to share, email theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.